You may be seated. I don't actually think that's a bad proverb. The parents eat sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. I know the point of our Ezekiel passage today is that that proverb is wrong. Yahweh gets very worked up about it. One's actions and not one's ancestors determine one's fate. We aren't punished for the sins of others. The one who sins is the one who dies, Yahweh summarizes with grim, almost elegant simplicity. I'm not so sure about that. This summer, as part of a research project on South Pacific villages being displaced by climate change, I sat with a group of Fijian women whose homes had been washed away 2 years prior by back-to-back cyclones that had hit the shore within 3 weeks' span. I had come to hear stories about rebuilding and the community's decision-making processes around relocation. Leaving one's land is a complicated business for indigenous Fijian communities. It's a grief-stricken business. But the village had come to consensus. They could not stay. The storms were coming more frequently. They were stronger when they came. The last storm had washed away decades of effort in this remote rainforest inlet. Everything we've worked for years is gone, one woman said to me. It's gone. There used to be a story that scholars told about that passage from Ezekiel this morning. And the story was that it was about individual accountability, that it was a turning point in theological ethics from the murky world where the consequences of sin were passed down from generation to generation to this bright new future where each person only had to account for their personal actions and their personal failings. And for the most part, the story was told as if this atomized way of understanding sin and consequence was progress and enlightenment. I mean, everybody gets a clean slate, a fresh start in a new race. Win or lose, it's in your hands. But the climate crisis presses into our palms a more difficult reality. It witnesses to a connected world. Over time and across space, we're woven together. And when the sins of ancestors tear that weave, generations unravel. When nations on the east side of the Pacific ignore their impact on the rise of temperature in the oceans, a village on the west side of the Pacific weeps. It's not just that climate disasters are indiscriminate. They call for communal accountability. They press the sour grapes of environmental catastrophe into a common cup. And they ask us to taste of each other's grief. Climate change tells us that others' cups of sorrow, their sour grapes, should be what set our teeth on edge. Because it's rarely the case that those beset by environmental loss are the ones to blame. And innocents die all the time. What those scholars of the past miss about Ezekiel 18, and what we could miss today if we're not careful, is that this passage also has communal accountability at its heart. In the passage's last 7 verses, God addresses God's people collectively 4 times. House of Israel, house of Israel, house of Israel, house of Israel. Get yourselves a new heart and a new spirit. Notice not new hearts and new spirits as if we all had our own, but get yourselves, plural, a collective new heart, singular, as if all of God's children share a body, share a common life. Individual action matters in this passage, yes, but not because we are insulated and atomized from each other. It matters precisely because we are not. We are bound together for good and for ill. This isn't a passage about assigning blame on the basis of tragedy. Anybody who's read Job knows that suffering doesn't follow an algorithm. It's a passage about accepting responsibility for the consequences of one's actions, yes, but more fundamentally, for the consequence, the weight, the significance of life. Life is precious, not in spite of the ties that bind, but because of those ties, and life is worth fighting for. More than that, life can be fought for. This summer was the hottest on record in many parts of this country. And when news outlets interviewed those sweltering in their kitchens, a weary fatalism was whispering. A fatalism not so unlike the shrug of Ezekiel's proverb. Nothing can be done. Die's already been cast. Others are to blame. One woman spoke of, quote, going all doomsday bunker in her thinking. Given forces so much greater than herself, resistance had given way to resignation. Her question had become very simple. How do I protect me and mine? Ezekiel was also composed during a time when destructive forces outside his people's control threatened to overcome their collective hope. They'd been conquered by empire, their leaders exiled, their temple razed. The loss was great enough that they had started to believe in a chillingly deterministic world. Nothing really mattered, certainly not the insignificant choices of their lives. And it's that chill that Yahweh refuses to abide. I hear an echo of God's dogged rebuttal of fatalism in the voice of one of the indigenous pastors that I interviewed in this project on climate resilience. His village was being impacted by his government's careless logging practices, which, when compiled with changing weather patterns, meant that there were these extended periods of drought punctuated by dangerous landslides when the rains finally came. Our village used to be known across Fiji for having the sweetest mangoes, he said. But when I came here as a pastor, the mango harvest was small and they were hard and they were dry. So I decided that I was going to start preaching about our relationships with each other, he said. There were grudges in the community. There were these two sisters that weren't even speaking to each other anymore. Resentments between families that went back years. We needed to improve our connection with God and our connections with each other if we were going to heal the relationship with the land. I'll be very honest with you. This would not have been my first line of attack in protecting the mangoes. What difference do individual relationships make in a world of global economies and international developers and weather patterns formed by the rising temperatures of oceans? This sounds rather fuzzy in the relation of cause and effect. Preaching is a roundabout method for changing crops. But I'll tell you what this pastor's plan was not. It was not the fatalism of that heat-sick woman who was ready to give up on local relationships altogether. This was not resignation. He didn't throw up his hands in despair or place the fate of his people at the feet of a different empire, on a different continent, half a world away. He was fighting for the life of his village every way he knew how. And this pastor, more than most, knew what he was up against. He'd been an influential government official before he accepted this call to pastoral ministry, which is why I could ask him a follow-up question. "Pastor," I said, "you know that climate change is not just about a broken relationship between two sisters. It's about the broken relationship between nations and the broken relationships of history and colonialism. It's about broken legislation in my country and broken accountability structures in yours. How do the relationships of a small village make any difference to problems that big?" He took a breath, a long breath. This wasn't a new question for him. "Jerusha," he said, "everything you say is true. But I'm a person of faith. And I believe small things matter. It's Founders Day at Duke Divinity School, a full year after the school announced its climate commitment. Our formidable resources, our reach of global research partnerships, the depth of our roots in the North Carolina landscape make us seem anything but small. We're gathered under towering buttresses. We're getting ready to celebrate our centennial. And I'm grateful that this institution has rejected the undertow of fatalism in a fight for life that will define the next generation and perhaps many more. To those institutional leaders present today, thank you. But even with our resources, one only has to scratch the surface of this crisis to feel the smallness of our hands. How little we control. The concerted, coordinated efforts of this R1 research institution are dwarfed by the gathering storm. I tell you today what this Fijian pastor told me because he thought someone should know. The mangoes in his village got sweeter. Sour fruit became sweet through restored relationships. That's his testimony. Now it would take a whole other research project to figure out what that means. Well, it might be the rainfall was different that year, but there are other possibilities. Maybe better village relationships led to more cohesion and advocacy efforts with the local government. Maybe village men that had seasonal jobs with the forestry service started organizing for change. Maybe community women spent more time together caring for those mango groves. Or maybe there's a far more complicated connection between cause and effect than is dreamt of in our philosophies. Whatever the reason, the idea that small networks of local relationships make a difference in the climate fight, that's not a new idea. And it's supported by data. Dr. Elizabeth Albright is an associate professor of environmental ethics at Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment. She studies how natural disasters impact the long-term well-being of local communities. I first heard about her research at an interdisciplinary teaching and learning event that brought together natural and social scientists, public policy specialists, and theologians. Together with local clergy, to think about how faith communities could further the work of climate justice. Duke Marine Lab was our host, and this year the gathering was funded by Nicholas School's Climate Research Innovation Seed Program, better known as CRISP. Now, not everybody in that conversation identified as a person of faith, but every last one of us were convinced that faith communities were necessary to this work. Dr. Albright laid out sobering statistics about how wealth inequalities worsen every time a natural disaster hits. She had chart after chart from scholars across her field showing how the wealth gap widens between white communities and communities of color after every storm, regardless of education, regardless of relief funding. Climate change was reifying the ugliest legacies in this nation's history. And then she said this: there is a mitigating factor that has statistically made a significant difference. If communities build relationships before the storm, recovery looks different. Noticeably different. Well, you would have thought the clergy in the room all got 2 inches taller all at once. Here was a bona fide scientist telling them that the very work they knew how to do, keeping track of shut-ins, attending ecumenical council meetings, organizing a community food bank with the church that looks different or worships different, serving sandwiches with the women's group in the fellowship hall, getting coffee with the Spanish-speaking pastor down the street, or the English-speaking pastor if you're the one that speaks Spanish. All of those things, those small things, have consequence. That's not so much different than the Fijian pastor's testimony, or from what Yahweh told God's people through the prophet Ezekiel. Your choices, your relationships, your commitment to life and the ties that bind. Those things matter. I wonder if at the end of the day, the most significant ways that Duke will move the needle in its climate commitment are through the investments it makes in its relationships. It's relationships with local communities and the interdisciplinary relationships between its scholars, and its relationships with an increasingly connected world. I know that slow, humble work. Relationship building accepts responsibility for the damage the institution has caused, whether in this generation or the generation prior. And it works to undo it. And it works to rebuild trust from the ground up. That's not easy work. And it's not flashy. But it may finally be the work that is most consequential. Today is not only Founders Day, it's also World Communion Sunday. It's a day when we remember the world that is held in God's body by the power of the Spirit. The God of Ezekiel not only wanted God's people to know that their lives mattered, God wanted them to know that life matters to God. This table, to extend a beautiful phrase by Anethea Portia Young and her reflection on Ezekiel 18. This table is not just a place we look back. It's a place we look around. It's a place where the responsibilities of relationship are pressed into our hands. And when we are pressed into the hand of God, a God that presses back all of our excuses in the fight for life, and a God that asks us to do the same. Interestingly, our gospel reading also references grapes today, or at least a vineyard. They're two brothers. One who pays lip service to the work required, one who says all the right things, and never shows up. And the other who, for whatever reason, determines that sour fruit is not his responsibility. I see that other brother on the road, convinced in his decision. And I see him pause and turn. Jesus doesn't tell us why. But it's no small thing, that turning. It trusts that a different path is possible. The change is possible. The communion table requires just such a turn. So come, heart pressed against your chest, breath warm in your body. It's not too late in the day, even now, when so many have died. You are alive, connected to a living world and a living God. And life is a matter of consequence.